You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to the Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the Sound and beyond, with a local perspective. And I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today we're going a little further afield, and we're going to be talking to author Jane G. Haig. She lived in Alaska for almost 40 years, and she's the author of books about the Alaska Gold Rush, including Gold Rush Women, Children of the Gold Rush, King Kong, and Searching for Fanny Quigley. She's been interested in renewable energy, energy conservation, and urban planning since attending architecture school. And she designed and built a super insulated passive solar house with solar collectives, and that was back in 1986. We're going to talk to Jane about her new book, Waiting for the Storm, a Green New Deal novel. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you.
I'm so glad
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad you're here.
We've all been anxious and waiting for the storm for a few years now. So I think this is really, you know, a spot on subject. But you've been writing about nonfiction for your entire life. This is a novel, and it's not only a novel, but it's set in the future. How did that come about?
Well, I'll tell you, it really started with the opportunity to participate in NaNoWriMo, which is National Novel Writing Month, and take a break. I really needed a break from some nonfiction I was trying to write with a lot of footnotes, very technical, and I thought, you know, I'm just going to take a little one-month break and try something different, kind of loosen up a little bit. And that was one impetus for writing a novel, and also the Green New Deal, which came about, I think, in 2018 and 2019. And I thought, you know, I got very enthusiastic about it, and I've been very disappointed that some of the things that have been predicted to be part of it haven't really happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought it would be a lot more fun to make it a novel than to try to write a polemic.
That's true. And it's the middle of the pandemic.
And a lot of people
were writing polemics about that and energy conservation and climate change. So kudos to you. This is set in the future, but it's something that it's quite, I don't know, is it attainable, the kinds of things that are happening in your book?
Well, I think that it is, and I think that's one of the themes of the book, is that we can do it ourselves, that these things can happen if we kind of will it into being. One of the main things in the book is a linear town that goes about 6.5 miles from a university town here in New Hampshire where I'm living to the town over where many of the students are actually living because of the housing shortages in their university town.
And this is University of New Hampshire.
Correct.
Well,
I took some liberties with the University of New Hampshire and its neighboring town in terms of what they might or might not actually want to happen.
Right. Well, you know, before we get into discussing that too much more, let's give people a taste of the book by doing a short reading. So I'm going to ask you to read from chapter 2, and you can say what you want to introduce it or just start on.
Okay, I'm just going to start in here.
Mm-hmm.
This starts with Barney. Barney had started his brew pub in the vast basement of one of the huge abandoned 150-year-old mill buildings in Dover. By the mid-20th century, the mill owners closed up and moved jobs to the south where labor was cheaper. The old mill stood empty for years. When Barney started back right after college, downtown Dover was a dead space and the mill scene was far from trendy. Barney was one of the first young entrepreneurs to begin to revive the area by converting them to businesses and then trendy lofts and offices for tech companies. Barney, Katrina, and Chip had all met as students at UNH, majoring in sustainability in the mid-2000s. When they graduated in 2006, Chip and Katrina started their solar installation business, Solar New Hampshire, and Barney had his brew pub up and going, at least the beginnings of it, with the Live Edge bar, with taps behind, an assortment of antique tables and chairs, a few snacks, but not much more. Still, they wanted to continue their work as activists focused on the livability and sustainability of the Dover-Durham region as they faced radical climate change. So they gathered a few of their college friends and began meeting on Monday nights to try to figure out how they could influence progress in their local region. Planning would have to link efforts in housing, transportation, and energy so that locally and regionally, people did not have to drive polluting, gas-guzzling cars from their rural and suburban homes to work, school, and strip shopping malls. Electricity production would have to rely more on renewables, and grid transmission had to be modernized, and they would have to address housing. Affordable housing was scarce in the entire region, and what housing there was had been built in areas nearly inaccessible without a car. There would be an opportunity to build new housing along rapid transportation corridors. It seemed an unlikely group. Spencer, a freewheeling New Hampshire surfer, was working at a sports shop. Alex had grown up in the North Woods and become a civil engineer. Nick got a job in the planning department at UNH. Avery went to MIT for a master's degree in planning. At first, they worked with groups in New Hampshire and throughout New England and through existing channels like the planning commissions and the legislature, but they found it frustratingly difficult to make any real impact. That's when they decided on their radical Go Local plan. The whole region might not adopt radical change. There were too many holdouts in New Hampshire who would never give up their waterfront property or their rural lifestyles or their SUVs and pickup trucks. But at least they could institute change in their small part of the world. Katrina, always the planner, devised a three-pronged plan. First, they would have to understand how local decisions were made. Who made the decisions and where did they get their information? How could they intervene? Then they could reach out for expertise, make their own plan, and finally, they could get their members onto the boards and commissions that made the decisions. From the very beginning, they dreamed of a light rail connection between Durham, the home of UNH, and the larger city of Dover. They referred to it as the Connector, or DART, the Dover-Durham Area Transit. They had always envisioned it as the driver of the new economy connecting the two towns only 6 miles apart. But more importantly, it would anchor what they were calling the corridor. Gradually, they began to realize that they would have to do an end run around the official county and town planning groups if they wanted to get anything done, and they began calling themselves the Rump Caucus. The Rump Caucus adopted the long game, each working their way up in various administrations. Nick got a job in the planning department at UNH. Avery got a job in the planning department for the city of Dover. Others got themselves elected to local commissions and planning boards. Chip and Spencer won election to the New Hampshire State House. Together, they were planning the entire time, and the game was to be ready with detailed plans when the time was right. When the Green New Deal money finally began to flow, they were ready to make their small part of the world more sustainable for their community for generations to come. All their while, they had their eyes on the prize. They envisioned a light rail connection between Dover and Durham becoming the spine of all new sustainable developments. Right from the beginning, Barney and friends worked with UNH faculty in Durham, many of whom they had conveniently gone to school with. UNH planners created a strategic growth plan that recognized the challenges of climate change. They started by adopting a 100% renewable energy goal, which they achieved by 2020. That turned out to be the easiest part. While Chip and Katrina themselves had focused on solar energy for individual homes, the entire electric grid was a bigger problem, an artifact of the mid-20th century, which at the time had not been modernized for decades. New Hampshire's utilities commission had entirely failed to upgrade to a smart grid, which might have provided incentives for consumers to alter usage during different times of day based on pricing signals. Transportation and housing were the next issue, but it was a chicken and egg problem. People did not see the point of living clustered along the train tracks if there were only one or two trains running each day. Detractors complained it wasn't practical to increase train service or build light rail because everyone already had cars and wouldn't give them up. Year after year, all through the 2000s and 2010s, New Hampshire, like all the other states, spent billions on expanding interstates from two lanes to three and then four, and still the traffic got worse. And they had been successful. The university in Durham had worked with the community activists on the plan right from the beginning. even before they had managed to pack the planning boards in both Durham and Dover. With some prodding from activists, the university resolved to build all its new buildings in the corridor, every new dorm, all new faculty housing, and most of the new research facilities and classroom buildings. The rest of the campus, the legacy dorms, administration, classroom and office buildings, and labs, would be accessible with the electric, self-driving, last-mile autonomous vehicles, llamas, and UNH's electric trams, which ran every 5 minutes. The Transportation Project Lab had designed those, too. By the time Jazz had returned to Dover, Jazz is really one of our main characters, and by the time she returned to Dover, sustainable, affordable condos, apartments, and retail establishments had grown up on the Dover end of the DART, including the townhouse and apartment project where she now lived, once a barren parking lot for the Amtrak rail station that carried commuters to Boston, now no longer needed thanks to DART. Beyond Dover, more apartments and condos, as well as workshops, light industry, and business had grown up along the corridor. For those who lived and worked in the corridor, the llamas and trams weren't even necessary. No buildings on the corridor were more than a five-minute walk from the DART. Jazz remembered living in one of the older-style apartment housing complexes built out beyond the city centers, because that was what was available, and because they provided parking, which was essential in the old economy. She and her roommates had had to drive everywhere. All of them had been raised in the old economy, relying on cars. Many needed cars to get to the job or to get home to visit their parents in rural or suburban New Hampshire or Massachusetts. It was a self-reinforcing circle, but the new dorms and apartments on the corridor broke the circle for new students. There were many jobs available at UNH or in Dover or Durham, no car necessary.
That is so exciting. You just laid out a blueprint, a very positive blueprint, Jane, and I know other people listening are thinking that too. So in case you're wondering, we're listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and we're talking to author and historian and educator Jane G. Haig, who has written a book called Waiting for the Storm, a Green New Deal novel. So Jane, why so many books looking 20 or 40 years ahead are very dystopian? They want to scare people into action. Why did you decide to go another way?
Well, I really didn't want to write a dystopian novel. Honestly, I had that feeling, you know, there's just so much looking forward and seeing bad things happening. And I had been really influenced by the book Ecotopia back in the 70s, I think. So that was really a model. And that envisioned an ecotopian world in the Pacific Northwest. And I finally got a copy of it, and it's a little bit dated and kind of misogynistic, to tell you the truth, if anybody wants to go back and read it. But I thought, you know, this could really use updating, and we could use a positive view of the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So are some of the things, you know, you chose Durham, and between Durham and Dover, are some things happening there now or could happen there? Is that why you chose that
area? Well, to tell you the truth, I chose it because I looked at the map of the Amtrak lines where there was a right-of-way, and there really is a 6.5-mile right-of-way between Durham and Dover, and they're part of a region called the Seacoast, which has a tremendous housing problem.
Mm-hmm.
Also, UNH really is renewable energy self-sufficient already. So I looked that up, and they use a variety of renewable energy sources, so they kind of have a positive outlook.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't actually do any research about whether they're going to do much else. Chances of them building a light rail line, it could happen.
I know. It's sort of, if you're, you know, people listening are thinking, well, how does this apply to us? And, you know, I don't see how much longer we can drive from Bainbridge to the Olympic Peninsula on the two-lane road that exists there without doing something. And so that's what got me excited as, envisioning some kind of light rail or transportation or self-driving cars, something for our area. Now, also I want to ask you, because we haven't even mentioned it, waiting for the storm is not waiting for climate change storm necessarily. There's a hurricane involved here, and that seems improbable for this area, but I think you have another reason why you chose to have a hurricane occurring during this book.
Well, I needed a plot, let's just be frank. And there really was a hurricane in 1938 that came up as far as Providence, and there was one sometime after that which actually ripped through New Hampshire and destroyed hundreds of thousands of acres of forest.
Wow.
So it's improbable and it's unlikely, but look at what just happened to Vermont.
Right.
You know, this was after I wrote the book, right? And they just had a storm that wasn't even a hurricane that flooded Vermont. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and the other thing was there's a plot device there in which one of the main characters is working on a solar house on the seacoast. And, of course, that's now threatened by this hurricane. So the question is, you know, what's going to happen to the actual seacoast, the buildings along the coast itself? And that's really an important consideration, too. So the people in the corridor who are tucked safely away about 15 miles from the coast aren't really threatened by the storm, but the people on the seacoast really are.
Uh-huh. You talk about something called the Great Gridlock around Boston and I-93, and I thought it was fascinating to think about, you know, a disaster like this hurricane coming where everyone knows it's coming and there's a huge evacuation that needs to take place. And what's the problem with evacuating all of the people in this area where the hurricane's coming to?
Well, I don't know if you all remember, but there have been a couple of disastrous evacuations, mostly in Texas and parts of the South, where people actually got stuck on interstates and freeways in the midst of when the storms were arriving. And I don't think we really give enough thought to how we're going to get people away from some of the coastal areas. I mean, around Boston, there's a really limited number of roads away from the coast, and most of them are these twisty, turny,
just like here.
Roads.
Just like here.
Yeah. And, you know, I really don't think that we give enough thought to what's going to happen. I really did a lot of research for this book. Like you said, I wrote it during the pandemic. I spent a lot of time on the couch reading about hurricanes of the past, evacuations of the past.
So it was a kind of a couch escapism. But also, okay, so these characters, I love it that they're from all different walks of life. Let's just pick somebody like, and also you have some sustainable farms involved, like at Everly and Goat Hill Farm. Let's talk about the people that live there and what they're trying to do.
Right. Well, there's a farm, and there's something called an agri-hood. I don't know if you guys have heard of agri-hoods there, but the idea is that, you know, right now we mostly picture one farmhouse in the middle of some acreage, you know, maybe 200 acres or something. But really, a farm could sustain a lot more people than that, not through farming necessarily, but as a place to live. And especially if people are working at home. Of course, that idea came from the pandemic as well. And with tiny houses, people could be located on the farm.
I think that's happening here. That's definitely happening here. Right.
Yeah, I don't know if you, yeah. So
it involves,
I kind of got that idea involved.
Right, food and housing. Right. Housing is a big issue here in Port Townsend and has been, and in the valley, as well as encouraging local farms and local food, because we realize we're going to be cut off if we have any kind of a major earthquake or tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
So the food, this farm, you know, can help feed people, take people in. What about the energy situation? If, you know, some people are putting in solar panels, but those don't actually help if the grid goes out. What's the answer
to
that?
Well, the answer to that is microgrids, which connect people in a specific small area and with batteries. And those have gotten more and more prominence, I would say, in the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that it's a pretty robust battery connected to solar energy and maybe a generator that can island, they call it, off of the grid. So it disconnects itself from the grid in case the grid goes down. Because I don't know if you remember a hurricane that came through some years ago in New York City.
Yes, yes.
And it turned out the gas stations didn't even have electricity.
Right. So many things go wrong. You know,
right.
That you're not thinking about, or the average person isn't thinking about, that they can't pump gas. I have a friend that never lets their gas tank go below a half, just for that reason.
Gas stations, and also, of course, you know, gas stations, and also hospitals,
mm-hmm.
and airports. So now they're increasingly installing microgrids in some of these, and also emergency service, you know, centers for cities and towns.
Yeah, well, one of the things, you know, that I immediately after finishing your book went, okay, well, what's our situation here? And I had to admit that I really didn't know. So I found out that most of our electricity comes from hydroelectric, comes from the dams, and there's also a percentage of nuclear energy that comes here as well, 5%, something like that, you know, and maybe 1-2% from solar. But there's a drought, and so, you know, they're now talking about the, you know, one of the major dams is, you know, kind of concerned about the water not producing electricity. So the microgrid could be an answer for small local areas, you know, like the, you know, small towns around the Inland Peninsula. Could it?
Well, I think that, you know, where your energy is coming over the grid from a long distance, mm-hmm. I think it's a really good idea to have a kind of a backup system with renewable energy. It would seem you guys have some wind, huh?
Yes, we do, but there isn't really anything that's taking advantage of the wind locally or the tides. And, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago, there was talk about that. And I don't really know where it's going right now, but we can all hope. So there's also the transportation. And do things work out during the storm the way that there is, you know, the transportation has been, you know, does DART work? Do the llamas work in a storm situation? Did it help evacuate people?
Well, I mean, the people that are connected to the DART and connected with the llamas aren't trying to evacuate. It's the people from Boston who are trying to get up to that region,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which is like actually an hour and 15 minutes away or so, and they're stuck in this gridlock on the Boston interstates. And I think it's important to know that even if we all start driving EVs tomorrow, electric vehicles tomorrow, it's not going to solve the traffic problem necessarily. You know, we'd all have to start taking rapid transit in order to solve some of the transportation problems.
So, right, and nobody wants to. So.
Well, in the book, that's why I envisioned the great gridlock in the book, actually, in which Boston has the most massive transit, or the most massive traffic jam ever,
mm-hmm.
which inspires them to finally invest in the rapid transit that they should have been investing in for about the last 30 years. So our region is very connected to Boston, and then that also inspires them to develop a rail line. But
that runs along the highway.
That runs from here to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take a lot of mass transit and a lot of investment. Mass transit doesn't work unless it's frequent.
Yes.
It has to be frequent and convenient and reliable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that takes investment.
Yeah, and people thought that, Lyft and Uber were going to, you know, help us reduce our dependency on so many cars.
Actually, that's like a complete myth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody ever thought that was going to reduce dependency on cars. It really adds cars.
Right.
I think it was just a move by venture capitalists to make a lot of money off transportation and take people away from the rapid transit. So
mm-hmm.
they're taking people off buses and putting them into cars that just clog up the roads in Boston.
Okay.
People are going to have to take the subways.
So there's also, you know, we're talking about evacuation. And in the book, there is mentioned the Bangladesh plan. What is the Bangladesh plan?
Well, the Bangladesh plant actually is a real thing in which they, you know, Bangladesh is like at sea level. And there's millions of people who live at sea level in an area that could flood and has flooded, you know, to the depth of maybe 4 or 5 feet. And the plan is to build enough platforms that are above that level, you know, that are 10 or 15 feet high, that could sustain people in small areas so that everybody isn't trying to actually leave.
There have been some platform building things going on out at the native villages on our coast, as far as I know. So the schools.
Yeah, I've heard about those. Yeah. Some of the beaches and some of the real coastal places. And so I sort of envision it for Cape Cod, because Cape Cod is a real bottleneck. Mm-hmm. People couldn't all possibly get off of Cape Cod.
No, and I actually wouldn't want to be on one of those platforms with a whole bunch of people, you know, in an entire situation. Anyway,
well, you'd rather be on one of those platforms with a bunch of people than on the Sagamore Bridge.
True, that is true. Okay, so we're running a little short of time. Let's talk about the takeaways for this book. What do you want people to take from this book and move on?
Well, I think one of the things is that the reason I invented the Rump Caucus is the idea that we could take on the planning ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, the people in the Rump Caucus kind of invent a plan, and they come up with a way to make the plan themselves and wait for the money to come and have the light rail built as a kind of a demonstration project. They're not waiting around for a top-down plan.
Yes. So what we're trying to do is organize, not wait around, make our own plans, and get yourselves elected to your local planning boards.
Exactly. Organize. Planning.
That's
and
right.
And the second message has to do with sustainability. There's two characters in the book.
Thank you, Jane. We have to cut it off there. You've been
Thank
listening.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You're welcome. You've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, a program for everyone who hasn't read everything. We've been talking to Jane Haig all about her book, Waiting for the Storm, a Green New Deal novel. Thanks very much, Jane, and we'll see you next time.
And today's Indian music selected by the author, Doogie MacLean, the song Ready for the Storm.
The waves crash in and the tide pulls out. It's an angry sea, but there is no doubt that the lighthouse will keep shining out to warn the lonely sailor. The lightning strikes and the wind cuts cold through the sailor's bones, through the sailor's soul, till there's nothing left.